Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
For years, the online far right was a chaotic digital sideshow. If you saw any of it, it was bizarre memes and live streamers and lots of trolling and racist jokes. And mostly it seemed stuck there in the darker corners of the internet. But the journalist Antonia Hitchens says that world isn't on the outside anymore. Hitchens begins her article in The New Yorker last summer with the moment when Elon Musk's AI chatbot Grok started calling itself Mecha Hitler and was talking about another Holocaust. And this is what happened when Musk asked users to supply the system with what he described as politically incorrect information.
It became kind of trendy among certain sets to say that Hitler hadn't really been the bad guy of World War II. It may have been Churchill, or that actually there was no way of knowing really how to come down specifically on which one of them was to blame for anything. And so I met one of them in person who became part of the subject of my piece on Groypers.
Groypers are what we've come to call these young, deeply online activists who are trying to cram their white nationalist ideas and conspiracy theories into conservative politics. They're almost always followers of the podcaster Nick Fuentes. They're almost always men. And Hitchens' story is called How the Internet Fringe Infiltrated Republican Politics. One of the Groypers she writes about is a young man she calls G.
During our first meeting, G, who is in his early 30s and who wore a suit with a skinny tie, performed what appeared to be a Nazi salute, then took a sip of water, chuckling to himself. His pose is both a joke and completely serious, he said. The world is just so tragically f***ed up. You can't look at it and not have a sense of humor. This attitude was designed to prevent him from blackpilling, shorthand for spiraling into the belief that the future is doomed.
To the untrained eye, a lot of these people are well-educated, clever, articulate, pretty normal to go for a drink with, and kind of one click further reveals a different reality, which is the way that they comport themselves online. It brings together actually a rather diverse, I'd say, array of characters who kind of have united on what they see as sort of a positive, upbeat mission to change politics from within by pushing these sort of what they would call Groyper ideas into the mainstream.
But here's the twist. The Groypers aren't just going after Democrats. Yes, of course, they're mocking the left, but they're also going after Republicans, even very conservative Republicans.
The message is always like, you're a traitor, G said. He and his friends pounce on anyone who identifies as conservative, yet denies the existence of a so-called great replacement. The theory that liberal elites have conspired to flood white America and Europe with migrants from the third world. The same goes for anyone who suggests that America is a country defined by shared creeds, not just Anglo-Saxon ancestry. Basically, anytime there's a Republican who countersignals white advocacy or white people at all, we shit down their throat, he said.
And all of this is putting Republicans in a tough spot. The party knows how extreme these Groypers are, but they still need the votes, the warm bodies, to keep the coalition together.
It's a very difficult problem for them to solve if they in fact do want to solve it, because their movement has kind of an inherent aversion to what they would see as kind of moralistic, sanctimonious drawing of boundaries for who can be in the movement. It is something that they kind of associate with the language of what they would call the left, you know, saying if you don't support trans rights, you can't be in the Democratic Party is kind of the example they would give. And so I found that there was an incredible awkwardness around the subject because, you know, for most Americans, Holocaust jokes are just not like a winning platform for the midterms. But there's still not really a desire to say, you know, I think the way the vice president put it, these endless self-defeating purity tests are not how Trump built the greatest coalition in history. And so, if anything, they were concerned more about how can we keep these people, not about saying, you know, let's cast out most of the young men and others whom we rely on massively for the support of our movement.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Antonia Hitchens is with us talking about how the politics of the online extreme is moving closer to the center of Republican power. In her piece, Hitchens says this. She says, attempting a coherent portrait of Groypers can feel a bit like trying to describe the plot of a surrealist film or a fantasy board game that takes place in its own universe.
I think all of us for years now have had different ways of defining something like the MAGA movement or of even defining the Republican Party. But defining something like Groyperism, which is so varied depending on whom you might ask, and also some people would say, you know, doesn't really exist and is only a way of charging anyone who the movement wants to kind of purge from it as being a Groyper, you know, like it's only a kind of deprecating charge. I think that when I would ask kind of most passionate adherents of this incredibly abstract movement, you end up in these long, winding conversations like a college seminar, defining terms and defining concepts. And there's kind of a skittishness to say that it's one thing or another because they worry that it might kind of necessarily make it kind of not something that many people want to join. And so one hesitates from defining it the way that, you know, years ago, you might have said the Republican Party is about, you know, X, Y, or Z. I think they didn't want to define themselves in such simple terms because the point was kind of breaking the system in a way that also it was meant to be incomprehensible to those who aren't part of it. But if you had to do kind of a summary of the talking points, it's, you know, dissociate completely from Israel, acknowledge America as a white Christian nation, and, you know, undo many of the progressive advancements that many people see as the great achievements of the past decades and have women stay home, et cetera.
Yeah. That idea of coherence is so interesting in the, like, there's this moment when G, you're talking to him at that America Fest in Arizona, and he tells you that, you know, they'd come for a particular reason, he and his friends, trying to unite super hard, he says, is a voting bloc, and then get every young conservative on board and just f- the GOP as hard as we can. And I think what's interesting about that is it doesn't sound just like nihilism or chaos. It sounds like they're looking for some kind of coherence, like something organized, even strategic. And yet there's that nihilistic tone in how they talk about the system. So how do you make sense of how those two things coexist? Because it seems they have a plan, a strategy. They want to be a voting bloc.
I think also there, when you mention nihilism, I think it's also a, in some cases, a really deep search for connection from people who have never found friends, who have never found political allies, who in many cases, based on their age group, were kind of home in isolation during COVID. And so if anything, I felt like there was kind of an online brain rot that was really formative to the movement, in which also these kind of esoteric concepts that you have to sort of see 40 times online before you realize, oh, you know, an image of the following thing connotes an attachment to the following concept. It's almost like, you know, unless you've studied something, you can't really speak to it. And so I think the nihilism, in fact, in many cases came across as sort of a finally getting to be part of a group that was engaging on the same conceptual plane of feeling understood. And so I think I quote G at one point saying, you know, that it was a magical moment of solidarity, of coming together. In that way, to me, it was very reminiscent of when you read about political movements in history where kind of people are finally coming out and meeting together in a public square. But in this case was much more a movement about kind of tearing down the pillars that already exist that they think are just completely not feasible for moving forward. It's not so much about, you know, what would it look like to really replace the system with a new system, which, you know, would require undoing 50 years of history. And again, just to be frank about this, being governed by people who are mostly posting a lot on Twitter.
Yeah. I wonder, where do women fit in this movement? I mean, there are a few gripettes that you describe. Eager, you say, to undo the corruptions of feminism and return to some of these older modes of gender relations. Are there many women in the movement, and what do they have to say about all of this?
Yeah, again, I was really struck in person by how many women I met who, even a few years ago, would have wanted to, you know, work in the Trump White House or would have wanted to head a Turning Point chapter, you know, various things that one might do within the GOP, for which there are many roles that women can now run for. But there was a funny dissonance of kind of being incredibly competent and ambitious and kind of, again, traveling to a conference to kind of work on these issues in a group, but at the same time saying, you know, we should stay home, we shouldn't vote.
Yeah.
At points, you kind of found it. Many of these they're younger people. And so I think a lot of these are things that are worked out by the time you finish university and are deciding which job to get. I think it's hard to imagine many of them really acting on this. But I think what they're getting at is just a sense of kind of meaningless, empty liberalism that's been forced on them and that felt like it wasn't delivering any of the kind of improvements that it was promised, and that the lives their parents had didn't feel available to them. And so the only way of kind of reacting would be this kind of almost a reactionary nostalgia for earlier times. I think it was more an expression of that usually than really wanting to give up the vote. I think likely many of them do vote and will continue doing so.
Yeah. We have to talk about Nick Fuentes, who shows up in the, of course, again and again in the piece. Maybe start just by talking a little bit about like where he fits in this world, what role he plays for Groypers. I mean, you could say he's the leader, but maybe that's not quite the right way to put it. Where does Fuentes fit in all of this?
Well, the way that I found most useful to understand him was closer to a fandom, not unlike the way Trump kind of has developed a fandom, or some people call it a cult, which I think might be a bit too strong. But I think the way that one can be united in loving a sports team, and even if it always is losing and, you know, always letting you down, it brings you together and it brings you into something that goes a little bit beyond the kind of quotidian experience of life. And for many younger people, Trump wasn't really, you know, they say he's a boomer and he loves gold. He's always in, you know, Trump merch. And to them, you know, it had to be cooler than that, which the embodiment is a guy on a live stream wearing a suit from a basement in Chicago doing, you know, a long kind of extended political stand-up and then taking basically questions in the form of a super chat where followers pay to ask questions or make comments and are then, you know, kind of denigrated. I would kind of compare it to like a long Tucker Carlson monologue of political analysts followed by really just some kind of almost gossip site, Daily Mail, kind of what has everyone seen online. Like, it brings you together. But at this moment in our political life, that kind of person who's, again, totally divorced from real political power and lives alone in a basement is now kind of almost like a leader in exile of a certain faction of young people. And I should say it's probably a quite diverse audience who take a lot of pleasure in just watching the show and being able to laugh at these jokes, which, again, until recently were not allowed to be made on any other platforms in America where we prize free speech so much. And so I think in some ways it did feel like a slight overcorrection from one can't say it and so now let's gather and say it every night. But I tend to think of it more as, again, fandom around that figure than a kind of we want to in our own lives articulate a vision for really implementing the positions discussed on the show. It's kind of a very joking, not joking vibe that has allowed him to throw it.
I think the thing that really interests me is this sort of the internet as the kind of like an ideological engine of the movement. These platforms, the internet platforms, they don't just amplify their views, they kind of shape them. And so there's this transgression, memes and irony and this in-jokes and trolling. And it seems like that kind of the jokes and the trolling, that's like structurally important for this. Like, one of the dynamics in the piece is how these ideas might start as jokes or provocation, and then they kind of evolve into something more serious. Like, there's a kind of progression where there's trolling and then a lot of irony and a lot of shock value, and then it kind of hardens into something like a true belief. Is that right? Are you seeing something like that?
I think, you know, Trump is really our president is a poster. I mean, think about he's up late at night doing these long diatribes that are, you know, there are memes in them. There's celebration of Robert Mueller dying. They're kind of jabs at people that you don't even really know who are random. And I think, you know, some people would say, don't take it seriously. It's Trump. And other people say it's the president. And I think there is an element of that in what you mentioned about the kind of it's a joke till it isn't, where I did notice in my reporting the kind of cumulative effect on people of seeing the same joke over and over again in the kind of infinite scroll of the internet that the algorithm presents them on their devices, which they're on for most of the day, where when you end up meeting up in a group after, you know, 18 months of being exposed to that, suddenly you suddenly take a position on something about, you know, Jews or women or, you know, what have you, that is hard to take as truly serious because it seems so much like the kind of semantic satiation of just saying something that isn't really anything. But at the same time, when you have many, many more people saying those things, even if it's just meant to be about transgression, I think the question for the party and for the movement was sort of how do we want to respond to this? And that, to me, looks like it remains very open going into the midterms.
Fuentes, you say, and those like him can be understood as the most recent expression of a long pattern on the American right. So talk about where this is coming from, like the intellectual lineage of the movement, if I can put it that way. And how do you understand where this is? I mean, Pat Buchanan comes up. So how do you trace this sort of historically?
So Fuentes was first described to me as just a paleocon. And the Groyper Wars, as they're referred to, that started in 2019 when Charlie Kirk was first going onto campuses and kind of trying to sell these conservative ideas to liberals who, you know, he would say, come up and prove me wrong about, you know, what have you. And Fuentes would send into the audience Groypers from the internet to kind of go up and challenge them from the right with essentially paleocon ideas that were at that point so far removed from political discourse in the GOP, but kind of seeing a resurgence via this younger generation that had found the kind of Romney era Republican Party to be just so far away from what they wanted to see, that suddenly these questions of kind of talking about whiteness, talking about demographic replacement, talking about sort of cultural cohesion of the country that, you know, at that time were just really not spoken about, began to come up again. And I do think we've seen, especially in the second term with Trump, a much more kind of explicit embrace of and willingness to kind of bring those back into the mainstream of the party, whether it's in the way Secretary Rubio speaks of kind of not wanting to participate in the managed decline of the West, or Trump talking about kind of migration, destroying civilization, destroying the West. At the time that these ideas were first coming up again via Fuentes, I mean, they were seen as essentially fireable offenses to even speak in that cadence. Now I think they're much more kind of talking points where people don't bat an eyelash.
Fuentes, you mentioned, Fuentes says Pat Buchanan should have been the face of MAGA.
There's a lot of wishful thinking about what Trump could have been. And it often the end game of that is if he would have just been Pat Buchanan, this all would have worked out, which is just, again, very, very funny when you first encounter it, because it was a person who could never win an election.
Yeah.
So I think there's that, again, aspect of esoteric obsession of once Trump became kind of the winner who had this great comeback and who was, you know, lunching with billionaires and golfing and doing wars and putting gold on the White House, it just, you know, you become the establishment that you loathe. I would imagine if Buchanan won the election, they, you know, it would have ultimately been disappointing as well. The whole point is you can't win.
Well, the whole idea of, as you say, being disillusioned with Trump is big, but it seems like Trump was the one that got them interested in the first place. I mean, G told you that. He said he wasn't really animated by politics until Trump came along. And so that sense of disillusionment or disappointment must be pretty profound because they figured he was going to be the guy.
Well, I think when you imagine kind of to grow up in this movement from the time you're, I don't know, 8 or 10 years old, and now you're a late teenager or in college, you were already used to the kind of, they're coming in from mental asylums, they're rapists, etc. That was kind of the baseline of Republican politics that you signed up for. And so I think 10 years on, they're seeing a desire for that to be kind of extended to a new frontier, which some would argue, you know, Trump has been able to do much more this term than he was able to achieve in the first one, and actually has paid probably more attention than any president in recent history to their concerns. And then you have the vice president, who, you know, in addition to being very online, also speaks very explicitly about kind of America as a Christian nation. He hopes his wife becomes a Christian. He's very kind of enamored with speaking of the traditional family. And so it was a little bit, I think, surprising at first just how much these figures who seem to very much appeal to these same ideas were just kind of cast off as establishment losers who are in bed with Israel and big tech and have to be taken out of office immediately and replaced with the real thing in the form of Fuentes or whoever it might be. But I think, again, it's very hard to imagine a kind of electoral path forward for this movement.
Well, yeah, as you mentioned, these days now, Fuentes and others calling Vance a race traitor because of his wife.
Yes. And I think Vance at America First had a moment to say, you know, I don't want followers of Fuentes in this movement because they've embraced these ideas about, you know, my children being quote unquote mixed and, you know, my wife's heritage being disqualifying to my candidacy. But he was very careful to say that he didn't like anyone. I think it was, you know, quote, like either Nicholas J. Fuentes or Jen Psaki, if they insult my wife, you know, I hate you. But he was very careful not to say that he dislikes the fans. And so I think it's a conscious embrace and understanding that he'll need these people when he goes forward, if he does.
Antonia Hitchens. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker. Her story is called How the Internet Fringe Infiltrated Republican Politics. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about Groypers. It's the chronically online far right that's been pushing American conservatism further to the extreme. Antonia Hitchens has a piece in The New Yorker about the young men driving this world. Hitchens says the movement is becoming an influence inside of conservative circles. So we're talking about how Groyper ideas are moving into mainstream Republican politics. I think the Christianity part of all of this is interesting. You describe these young men greeting each other with phrases like "Christ is King," but what does that mean in practice? Because it's like, what do they really think of Jesus? How does Christianity actually fit into the movement? Because it doesn't seem like they're connecting to theology or doctrine. It seems like it's more like an identity marker than anything else.
I think it's a symbol of an imagined America that they didn't experience, where everyone was the same religion, and there were no data centers. There was no internet to kind of break their brains. There was no progressive march to insist on including all sorts of new people who would take away from the sense of cohesion of the country. And so I took it to mean in many cases not kind of a, I'm a devout Christian, but much more kind of this notion of if everyone were Catholic and traditional and kind of went to church on Sunday and you have a wife in a white dress who's blonde, and wouldn't it be so nice to then go to the orange grove and you have a nice brunch? And I think they're kind of conjuring that America that they articulate as having been lost to migration and kind of upheaval and change and globalization. But again, it's difficult to see what it would look like for that to come back without deporting 100 million people, which I think when you think of what the implication of that really is, it's quite profound. And I think would require methods that they then are very uncomfortable with. They don't want violence. They don't want people to even feel uncomfortable. And so in that way, it felt like kind of a Venn diagram of almost childish ideas, but that really had taken a become more popular in person than I think I had realized before I started reporting this piece.
Yeah. And do they even go to church themselves, any of these guys? And how many of them are actually married to the blonde girl in the first place?
I think it's more an aspiration than a reality. You know, I hesitate to run the numbers on anyone's religion or marital status, but I think it's more kind of a shared church of this online sphere in which, you know, there are values which are agreed upon as America First values. And even those, I think, in this milieu aren't seen as necessarily exclusionary. You can, I think one person put it to me, as long as you love peace and Jesus Christ, you can be a Groiper. It's not really about kind of meeting the actual identity so much as kind of embracing what it would mean for that to exist. So it's almost more like a cosplay.
One of the things that seems to be happening is the question of whether or not this world is getting close to actual power. Because you mentioned in the piece that there is a decent number of young Republican staffers who, or at least some sense, that they hold views that are kind of adjacent to this movement. Did you see any evidence of that and any ideas that at this point are actually influencing real policy or real political rhetoric in the kind of in the establishment, if that makes sense?
Sure. I think within the Trump administration and the kind of think tanks and institutions surrounding it, many of these ideas are not just popular, but kind of second nature. I think it's more, are you a Groiper in the sense of you would rather elect Gavin Newsom because he has a white family than J.D. Vance? I think that is not the view of the average person working at, you know, DHS or DOJ. I think in terms of has, quote unquote, the mass deportation effort been abandoned? Has the kind of effort to decouple from Israel been abandoned? The kind of the ideas that have a policy implication, I think, are quite popular in Republican circles and will remain quite popular in the kind of conception of whatever the 2028 edition of the party is. I think it's more the really out there online meme stuff that even if people do them on their anonymous accounts or, you know, in some cases on the social media accounts of the institutions where they work, I think they're, if you're in the government or you're in a think tank, you necessarily are kind of wearing a suit and trying to win and trying to really advance ideas in a way that is palatable. And so I think there's not really a desire to, you know, you wouldn't go up to someone and say, I'm a Groiper, but you might say, you know, the drawdown in Minneapolis was disappointing and next time we hope to go further. That makes sense.
Yeah. Well, and I won't get you to speculate on how many you think are there are in terms of the numbers, but you do mention the conservative writer Rod Dreher, who on Substack wrote that something like 40% of Gen Z staffers working in Republican politics were probably gripers. And then you ask an administration official about that, and the person who talked to you said it might be closer to 75%. So what do you make of that?
I mean, I was sort of using Rod Dreher's formulation as a frame from which to ask questions and subvert and deepen that calculation, which I think, even if incorrect, was something that drew a lot of attention to this movement. I think the administration official was speaking to describe Gen Z or Zoomer conservatives who are much more radical than the average Trump voter that you would have seen in 2024. I think, again, I hesitate to, one, run numbers that we don't have and that would be, you know, if MAGA is hard to pull, Groypers would be impossible to pull. But I think insofar as it articulates a rightward drift that has gone further than MAGA, in which, you know, one's son or daughter might want more advanced versions of the same thing, I think it's a useful kind of framework from which to understand the movement, and also a framework with which you don't have to get into all of the many different kind of, you know, almost like video game universe worlds of Groyperism, but you can just say it's if you're more right-wing than Trump. However, I think a lot of people on the right find that it's a way of kind of basically casting off any person who doesn't want to support Israel as, oh, you're a Groyper, and so you're an anti-Semite and gross, and what we have to do is continue doing what Israel wants. And so I think the kind of act of saying who is and isn't a Groyper is itself kind of a war within the party about what it's meant to be doing and who the real base and leaders are.
I wonder, your piece has gotten a lot of attention, and I wonder what you make of the reaction to it. I wonder if you've encountered any kind of, I don't know, skepticism about how, and maybe the premise of this is wrong, but I wonder if you've encountered any skepticism about how widespread or institutionalized Groypers are in you know, the Republican establishment. I mean, something that it's kind of marginal internet extremism, that's not really embedding itself into Republican staff culture. But what do you make of that larger question? Is that a misunderstanding of the piece itself? And what are you hearing in terms of reaction to it?
I think what's popular and you know, widespread is the feeling that the system is not working and the president's administration is not delivering on certain things that Republicans voted for. And even to extend beyond kind of right and left, that on both sides, there's a feeling that our politics isn't working and that it's incredibly polarized and that people don't connect with what elected officials are doing and that it's totally dysfunctional. And so I think insofar as that is kind of a distillation of where a lot of this Groyper stuff comes from, I think, you know, it's incredibly popular. Again, in terms of the really far gone, like, race science stuff that I think is ultimately not where most Americans want to see politics go, that is amplified on the internet by, you know, whether it's paid influencers or bots or kind of the algorithm that we don't totally understand. I think whether or not the ideas are popular, though they are, they're being seen much more frequently now, and that is still notable.
This was such a striking sentence that you wrote. Let me read it. I started to hear Trump described as a moderating influence on his own base. Talk a little bit about that, because that sounds astounding.
Yeah, I think that started in the fall for me when, if you think about the kind of elements that have fed MAGA for a long time, whether it's online, what some would call conspiracy theories, or whether it's kind of an association with... Can I ask you, before I forget, what did you mean by the big response and reaction? Because I actually am not sure.
I just heard this lot of discussion about it, and it seemed to me the and I didn't hear any critique of the piece. I don't mean to put it that way, but I think that there are some who are just like, look, they're not embedded in Republican culture. They're a an outlier. There, it's internet extremism, and I wouldn't freak out about it. Don't say much more. But it seems like what your piece is sort of getting at is, in fact, they do have a strategic plan to embed themselves and in a generation's time hold power. And I just have heard the discussion about whether or not that's plausible or true, not as a critique of the report, just as a critique about the viability of Groyperism in general. Does that make sense?
Yes. Okay, that's helpful. Because I guess what I would add is that, you know, if you were to go to a bar in Washington, D.C. or to a party with administration officials, I think the cadence, I think it's whether or not you're kind of one click more online and more kind of obsessed with Fuentes. But I think even people who are kind of active, you know, actively against Groyperism and who actively say this is foolish, if anything, it's because it detracts from the real work they see of kind of what would it mean to further platform kind of a focus on white identity if we have that done via this kind of loser online movement of weirdos. It takes away from the work that we're trying to do to kind of embed that into normal politics. So I think it's not so much a kind of rejection of the kind of would-be platform so much as a rejection of the style, which is, you know, unbecoming, they might say. But again, not always a huge difference in how the ideas would be phrased. I think it's much more sort of like, oh, it's not cool to be obsessed with Nick Fuentes. You know, we're doing something else. And I think maybe on the kind of loathing of women and the anti-Semitism kind of saying, like, we don't want to go there. But I don't think somebody would, you know, no one's uncomfortable here with joking about women staying home or the Jews. So I think in that way, it's come to encompass more than just online extremism.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned in the piece that someone close to the administration said to you that the Groypers, this is how they put it, the Groypers are to us as trans people are to the left. It's just a small fraction of the party that's mentally ill. And then they force you to, you know, lose elections.
I think that also speaks to, you know, what does it mean to have a big tent in a party? If you don't purge people, you know, need to win with them in your party, and that outreach can vary. But it'll be very interesting, I think, to see what it looks like in practice when it comes to winning an election, because I think it'll be a very different set of tactics than we were accustomed to in the past years. I think ground game might look very different. I mean, in the case of someone like James Fishbach, I met so many young people who, you know, had never been engaged politically in the real world, but saw an Instagram reel maybe that was put on their feed and then kind of were able to be brought into the fold of what felt like a politics. Mm. And I think that, you know, that wasn't happening 10 years ago because we didn't have these apps in the same way that we do now. It'll be interesting to see how people reach out to those voters and how the party decides if and how to kind of bring them along. And it's worth noting too, which I think probably your listeners know, the president did have dinner with Nick Fuentes at one point. Yeah. I mean, he said after Tucker Carlson interviewed him, you know, Tucker can talk to who he wants. I don't think we're, from this administration, going to see a kind of willingness to, it's sort of dispositionally unlikely to say, you know, don't talk to this person or he's a loser. I think you see it a bit with someone like Candace Owens or Carlson, who are a bit more kind of in the ether, but there hasn't really been a kind of push back against Fuentes in the same way.
That's Antonia Hitchens. We're talking about a recent story in The New Yorker. It's called How the Internet Fringe Infiltrated Republican Politics. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Sustain us at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist Antonia Hitchens. We're talking about her story in The New Yorker. It's called How the Internet Fringe Infiltrated Republican Politics. It seems like in the piece, there's this question about whether the movement isn't just going to be online, but it's going to appear in real-world campaigns. And there's this candidate, this person in Florida who seems to be embodying all of this, a guy named James Fishback. You met him in the, what was it, the parking lot of an Applebee's. Tell us about Fishback and where, I guess, where he fits.
So James Fishback is running for governor of Florida, and it's worth noting that he's running against Byron Donalds, who is the Trump-endorsed kind of MAGA candidate. And so it's kind of a primary from the right in Florida, premised on the notion that the right, as endorsed by Trump, is basically, you know, no longer relevant to the issues that young voters care about. And so Fishback comes in basically saying we should no longer support Israel. There's been a genocide in Gaza. The working class has not been taken seriously by this president. Young men who want to celebrate being white Christians shouldn't be kind of mocked and derided. And there was a huge amount of interest in kind of young people I met in Florida, whether at Applebee's or on college campuses, just in the kind of way that he was speaking. He was speaking closer to the kind of style in which Fuentes spoke, which is just, let's joke about all of this, nothing is sacred, and also kind of really conjuring this, again, reactionary nostalgia for an America that this generation didn't really know. And so he's running kind of as a, I'd say, Groyper adjacent candidate. Obviously, he doesn't say, hi, I'm a Groyper.
Yeah.
And I think it'll be really interesting to see not so much whether he wins, but whether this becomes a more popular mode for running. And I think, you know, we heard comparisons to Obama and Zoran Mondani from I think even the New York Times saying this is the future of how the GOP will talk. And I think it either will be or will be kind of deemed so unpopular and weird that it will be like a blip in our history.
So if Trump era populism isn't going to be thought of as the end point of the right, like what is it? And who leads the movement? Where does someone like Tucker Carlson fit? I'll just ask it like that. He's starting to see speculation that he himself is setting himself up for a presidential run. And there are, you know, things that he's saying, obviously distancing himself from Trump. I mean, the war in Iran, which you mentioned in your piece, was a major breaking point for a lot of them. So who would lead this movement, if you could even describe it that way?
Sure. So I think the question of the post-Trump GOP remains so unformed in some ways, because until recently, if you remember, kind of the talk was of, you know, Trump would joke about a third term. And the kind of message behind that to me was sort of that the movement was so tied up fundamentally with this personality and this kind of leader, a very specific movement that can't just simply be handed to J.D. Vance. And I think Turning Point briefly tried that in December. And, you know, it wasn't that simple just to say, if you liked this, now you like that, and it will be a continuation of that. And so many of the president's staunchest defenders from over the years, as the term goes on, have come to break with him, to for the first time publicly criticize him. I think the kind of sycophancy of the first months of the term in which, you know, we're putting Trump's name on everything, we're passing bills about how wonderful he is, and, you know, is he going to be on the money? I think that feeling has curdled into, you know, how far does the loyalty have to go when it's not reciprocated? And then also a kind of reaction of how dare you criticize the person who kind of has represented all of your aims and desires, and, you know, many would say also been shot at for your freedom. I think that kind of element of almost larger than life kind of I think Tucker Carlson said after the Butler assassination, you know, this person is the leader of a nation, not a president. And so I think that feeling for a long time kind of kept criticism at bay from top allies. But as 2028 approaches, there's more of a willingness to say, you know, this war is disgraceful. And I think a lot of the corruption on behalf of his family, which is so in the open and so over the top, there's a willingness now to say, you know, this can't be the future of what our movement is. But again, I'd say it's still very, very unformed, and I certainly won't speculate about who I think is going to run for president.
Yeah. Is this still politics in a traditional sense, or is it something else, something more performative or expressive, or is politics always performative and expressive?
I mean, Trump himself is, how often have we heard him described as a great showman? Yeah. But I think we now hear him described as a boomer, and the future of this I don't think will be like anything you've seen before, just because of the nature of how the world changes. I think, funnily enough, the Groypers probably would prefer something where, you know, it looked more like the 1950s, but now they have live streaming, and so it's an open question. But to your point about kind of Trump as a moderating influence, Marjorie Taylor Greene, for example, who broke with him after kind of his unwillingness, as she saw it, to take seriously the Epstein files and to really kind of take down the permaclass of corrupt pedophiles who run the system, in her view, described Trump as having caved to the political industrial complex. And I think in terms of being seen as a moderating influence, the kind of willingness to govern by having to get the Senate to vote for something, or, you know, get people at the rally excited about this or that, necessarily means capitulating to certain interests that are not kind of pure enough for kind of radical actors who desire kind of a perfection that's not possible in electoral politics in a democracy. I think that's part of a lot of the sort of dictator cosplay with, you know, Trump is meant to be Caesar, and instead he's kind of this weak old man. I think there's a desire to act in a way that even Trump has found impossible when you are an American president. And I think he wouldn't even really want to act in a way beyond that. We've seen in moments where he's actually retreated from that. But the moderation, I think, was speaking specifically about kind of the war in Iran, the Epstein files, sort of a capitulation with China, and also basically leaving behind the working class completely in favor of billionaires and tech leaders.
I think I know better than to get you to speculate on the future of Groyperism in American politics. But I do want you to at least tell me what you learned about, or maybe were you surprised about its what seems to be something more durable than you. I don't know if you had an impression early on. I mean, you talked to one Groyper, said, hide your true beliefs, gain power, gain influence, and then when the time is right, take power. And then a Trump staffer says that they're going to be running the party in 20 years because radical Zoomers, they've given up on Trump. And so I just wonder what you make of what you're hearing there about what you think, how the future of this is going to develop, just based on what you've noticed so far reporting it.
I think all of those statements, when read aloud, have to be kind of seen in the context of posters and people who will go to a James Fishback rally but do nothing else, necessarily cannot lead the party and be its future, because it requires a different kind of willingness to work in a system, even to overtake the party as Trump did. And so I think the question to kind of keep in mind is the extent to which these people begin to exist in a system which they think is corrupt and broken and has to be torn down. And there's talk of kind of, again, infiltrating it, which I think has happened to some degree. But I also think, I mean, it's interesting to listen to Fuentes, who, if you think about it, is like, you know, for hours every day, usually on a live stream dealing with these people who he's mocking and kind of openly contemptuous of. And again, I hesitate to analyze his true motives, but it's hard to imagine this as it is going on forever and just growing and growing more. I think the moment at which I wrote about it was a moment at which it felt to be kind of an embodiment of something happening in our politics. It was happening in this space. But I sometimes wonder, you know, even will that person be doing a multi-hour live stream in the coming years, or will he himself find a different kind of modality? I think I heard some kind of wishful thinking from Groypers that, you know, we're were waiting for Nick in 26 to run for president, but even something like that somehow always felt almost fanciful. And so I think the kind of the form that it will take remains very, very unclear, but the kind of feelings underpinning it are profound and can't only be laughed about.
Antonia Hitchens, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Antonia Hitchens. She's a staff writer at The New Yorker. Her story is called How the Internet Fringe Infiltrated Republican Politics. We'll put a link to it on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on Instagram at Radio West. We're on YouTube at KUER 90.1. And you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.